Well, you're at the conference. Good afternoon, and I am Representative Tammy Wilson, and we're going to start this committee on time. We have a lot of things we want to cover today. Today I have Representative Reinbold, Representative Gaddis, Representative Nagiak, and Josephson and Drummond are probably on their way somewhere. They've confirmed being here. And do we have anybody online?
This is Representative Wilson. I'm online.
Okay, so we have Representative Peggy Wilson and Representative Josephson. Welcome. That's what working girls do. So, thank you very much. And with that as a preface to it, we're going to ask the department to come up. I mean, cutting wood and gardening, just for anybody who needs to know. And welcome, Representative Drummond.
Oh, thank you, thank you.
And and just so you know, we have Representative Peggy Wilson online. And what we're going to do today is it's kind of broken up into four parts as it is. So we're going to go ahead and let the department do their presentation on each section, and at the end of the sections, then we'll take questions. And just make sure that you speak in the mics. We just had health and social service finance meetings, and it's very difficult for those online to be able to hear if we don't speak directly into them, and we don't want to frustrate Representative Wilson on such a nice day. So with that, we're going to start with standards, I believe.
If
you could introduce yourself, and you may begin.
For the record, my name is Les Morse. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. With me is Dr. McCauley, who's the Director of Teaching and Learning Support at the Department of Education and Early Development. So in our presentation today, we're going to hit not moving forward. Just a minute. There we go. Now everything is working. I'm just going to quickly go over the purpose, then we'll dive in. But we're going to provide an overview of the standards and assessment, the evaluation, and then the accountability system. And I want to be real clear that some of these, before the waiver, the accountability really came as a result of the waiver, but these will, after each section, will describe standards and assessment, implications of the waiver, because that's our understanding that you want to see what those implications are. And then we'll conclude the whole presentation with the issues around funding in particular, in terms of funding that comes with the Elementary Secondary Education Act, in terms of the state, as well as some districts, and we've actually pulled some sample districts. I basically pulled districts that I thought committee members would be familiar with as the samples. If you want to see all 54 districts, it's in a report that does come to the legislature that we could provide to the members. And then we'll look at, in concluding, any costs, if we didn't participate in ESEA, what that might be. But it's a little bit fuzzy, and we'll get to that at the end of the presentation. And we'll start with the piece on standards, and Dr. McCauley is going to cover the standards piece, and then I'll cover the assessment component.
Okay, and could you just briefly explain how we got to the waiver so that people realize that we're not any longer No Child Left Behind, or how that goes? And because we're going through a big change right now, if you could just give just a couple minutes of, you know, why all of a sudden, you know, we've got the standards now and new assessments, we're looking at teacher evaluation, what brought all that all together?
Okay, I'll give some context, and then as we cover each component, we'll actually say what the implications of that component are for the waiver. But what we didn't put in here and would probably be useful is context of how the waivers even came about. I think that's what you're specifically asking.
Absolutely.
So No Child Left Behind. I also want to be real clear about the law. So the original law passed in 1965 was called the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, often referred to as ESEA. ESEA has been continuously reauthorized. So when we refer to NCLB, technically it's ESEA as authorized by NCLB. So Elementary Secondary Education Act exists, but it gets reauthorized from time to time. The prior version of that was IASA, is the Improving America Schools Act in the 90s. So in 2001, NCLB reauthorized the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. It was up for reauthorization by Congress again in 2007. So it has not been reauthorized since its reauthorization date in 2007. So technically what that means is the Congress is just pushing it forward as long as they keep funding it. Well, the Secretary of Education made the decision that they would authorize waivers. They already had the authority under the law to authorize waivers, but not many states had applied for them. In this case, they outlined what would be an acceptable waiver to the U.S. Department of Education, and they invited states to apply for those. And that began about 2 years ago. Alaska didn't jump on board immediately. The commissioner and the governor at the time, well, the current governor, made the decision, let's analyze what other states are doing. Let's really see if this is a good thing or actually if it comes with more strings than what we currently deal with. So specifically, we made the decision to hold back as a state, analyze every application, and analyze the approvals that came through before we decided to apply. So our first, when we first applied, actually when we first made the decision to apply was in May of last year, after reviewing the early rounds of states getting waivers. So this is an approach the administration took because they felt that reauthorization was not going to take place, and so states were complaining about the law. It had some components that were simply outdated and didn't make sense. And so states could put forward plans within different areas of which we'll be covering. The truth behind the whole situation on some of these, we had already decided to do our standards regardless, which actually necessitates you do a new assessment. You can't have standards and assess your old standards and really think you're checking your system. So that was moving forward. We had actually made a decision to move our evaluation forward. That actually started as far back as 2008 with a work group that existed before waivers were even brought up. So those two components were moving forward. When the waiver opportunity came about, we looked at what we were doing within those, and we said that they fit the context of this waiver. And we could actually use Alaska's system to replace some of the things in NCLB, which we'll cover specifically what they are. The one thing that came about just because the waiver, because we didn't know the opportunity wouldn't have been there to change it under the No Child Left Behind, was the changes that you'll see in accountability specifically, school accountability. So as we go through that, that's really the only thing that changed only because the waiver allowed it. The other pieces were really moving forward as a state already. Does that give background?
Absolutely. I really want people to start getting kind of an idea of, you know, I know we moved from No Child Left Behind because there was also, we weren't going to meet all those, you know, targets as well, which I'm sure, you know, drove us to the waiver. But I wanted to make sure that people start understanding what benefits we may get from this, and that's kind of what we, how we got where we are right now. So with that, we'll start with the standards, and we'll let Dr. McCauley do that, and then we'll take questions.
I'm just going to provide a brief overview of the history of our standards and then the connection to the waiver. So the first review of our standards, our current, still relatively new, year-old English Language Arts and Math standards, was in February of 2010. For a year, there were meetings held with 229 stakeholders from seven regional areas across the state to determine what it was that we as a state wanted to do with regard to our standards. They looked, for example, line by line at our previous standards and the standards that were being developed across most of the country. They considered them in terms of rigor and their being developmentally appropriate. And at the end of that year of work, there were promulgated regulations to change our English language arts and math standards. Those regulations were out for an extended period of public comment for 6 months. They went out in December 2011. Between that time and their being approved by the state board, there were community meetings held across the state, and the result, and of course, lots of public comment that did result in some revisions to the standards that were approved. And the end of that, those 2 years of work were a new set of English language arts and math standards, which were adopted in 2012. So as Deputy Commissioner Morris has already stated, the connection to the waiver is that there are three principles in the waiver that are required, one of which is the adoption of what are called college and career-ready standards in minimally language arts and math, following whatever a state's adoption process is. The other component is that each state was required to provide assurance from the state university that the standards would result in students not needing remedial coursework at the post-secondary level. So there was an analysis of our standards done by the University of Alaska system and a written assurance that their impression was that if students met those standards, that would mitigate the need for remediation in college in Alaska. So because our standards met the criteria for being college and career ready, and because we had that assurance from the university, we knew that we would, at least with regard to that principle, be eligible for a waiver. We were already out in front with that work, and it coincided nicely with the first principle required for the waiver. So I'll just pause there for a moment before we move into assessment.
Does the committee have any questions about the standards? I guess I have one. Why are we just doing, since we're doing it on our own, why are we just doing English and math?
Well, we have other content standards. We have content standards in history and geography and science, government and citizenship. We actually have content standards in all of those areas, and we have performance standards in science and history as well. So it, English language and arts and math, our standards there were, I think they had been developed in 2006. A lot has happened in education since that time, a lot of information around remediation rates post-secondary, specifically connected to kids' abilities and skills in English language arts and math. And so those were perceived as the standards most needing a fresh look. Now, there's a phrase that I use when I talk with folks around the state is that our standards, our grade level expectations, were first generation standards. They were certainly better than the no grade level standards that we had before that. But it was really our first take as a state on developing standards to guide districts and schools. And so it was time for a revision in light of all that we know about student achievement and what it takes to be successful in the workplace and post-secondary.
If I could add to that, the other piece is the reading, writing, and mathematics are the three areas that state statute, even if the federal statute went away, the state statute says we will have standards in and we will test in those areas. We also test in science, but state statute doesn't mandate that. Federal statute does mandate that. So we decided even if we weren't doing the waiver, these are the areas we test in because the state statute requires that, so that's where we're going to put our energy first. Obviously, we probably want to update science at some point, but let's focus on the areas absolutely mandated by the state.
I have a question.
Go ahead, Representative Wilson.
Just to repeat, what does the statute say the state has to test on?
The state statute says that we need to have standards in reading, writing, and mathematics, and have a comprehensive system of student assessment around those areas.
Thank you.
Representative Reinbold?
Okay. Basically, what my question is I know these are more rigorous standards, and I want to know how many teachers were involved in putting these standards into place, and were they selectively invited, or was it across-the-board invitation? And then I've got a follow-up through the chair.
The majority of the 229 stakeholders involved were classroom teachers. There were representatives from post-secondary, from career and technical education, from business and industry, but the vast majority, I certainly could get you the exact number, vast majority were classroom teachers.
Okay, that would be great, because I'm getting a lot of questions asked, who was part of this, how come I wasn't, you know, and it's just nice to be able to say, hey, these are the people involved. If you have questions, you can go talk to them. As in a follow-up through the chair, I would want to know the cost of these more rigorous. Do you have an estimate on the cost of implementation of these new standards, and in particular the curriculum? And I want to also validate that at the local level, let's say like the Anchorage School District, is going to be able to choose the curriculum. It's not going to be a federalized curriculum. Is that correct?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Reinbold. There have been no requests from the department for increased funding to implement the standards. We have been doing, as a department, professional development and providing technical assistance around standards implementation with our previous standards. It is those funds that we are using to assist people in moving toward implementation of the new standards. So there haven't been any increased costs. You know, districts, for example, are required to have a six-year curriculum review cycle where at least once every 6 years, every content area is reviewed. So they are using their curriculum review cycles, which are required by regulation, now to do the work necessary to ensure alignment of curriculum and materials with the new standards. So with regard to the ability of districts to select curriculum, that is clearly indicated in regulation. It assigns responsibility for the development of reading, writing, and math standards, as Deputy Commissioner Moore said, to the department, and assigns responsibility for the development of curriculum and the selection of materials aligned to those standards to districts, not to the department.
Thank you.
So we've heard a lot from our constituents about the Common Core, and that we basically have adopted the Common Core because so much of it, of the Alaska standards. So if we had actually adopted the Common Core, like many other states, how would that have been different than what we did by doing a few changes and calling them the Alaska standards?
I think, Representative Wilson, it's different on both the front end and then the back end, so to speak, of the standards development process. On the front end, had we adopted the Common Core standards, we wouldn't have likely convened 229 educators from across the state to go line by line through the standards to determine that, yes, for example, we like the wording of this Common Core standard, but we want to add clarity, like the words with scaffolding and support, which was added to quite a few of our elementary literacy standards. We wouldn't have engaged them in conversation around what to do with elementary measurement standards, 18 or so of which are in our standards that are not in the Common Core. So the process that we went through, talking with stakeholders, having them compare our previous GLEs to the Common Core standards, and determining what to do standard by standard, we likely wouldn't have done that. We would have said we're adopting the Common Core standards. That's not what we did. On the back end, so to speak, adopting the Common Core standards restricts a state's ability to make changes to them. And something that might seem incidental in way of a change isn't incidental with regard to adopting the Common Core. Even adding words like with scaffolding and support, that's a change. And so the rules, so to speak, around adopting the Common Core were that they needed to be adopted in their entirety, and states could add up to 15% more of their own standards. And we didn't want to do that on the front end. And on the back end, now that we've adopted our standards, we want to be free to change whatever we want to change through the standards development processes outlined in regulation.
Perfect. Representative Gaddis. So just to be real clear, and clear to any of the folks that,
my house, we forget. And so just to be real clear, and for those listening in or who might listen later, what I think I'm hearing, and please correct me, is that there were a host of teachers from around the state and other folks, but a lot of teachers, that line item by line item, and if you will, looked at the Common Core standards and said pretty much, yes, that one, we can live with that. You know, I don't like this wording, But all in all, the standard itself, yeah, we can live with. Let's change this squidge a little bit. And then more importantly, they went through each and every one and said, you know, this appeals, this is what we're all about, and this is a higher rigor than what we're doing now.
Rep.
That being said, the state of Alaska has also chosen that as we go through this and down the road, that we also have an opportunity to make changes as we go along as well. So front end, people looked at it and really went through it. Bottom line is, where I get some grief is like, hey, we're not calling them Common Core, but they pretty much align themselves with the Common Core and the standards. And I think that what you're saying, that's pretty much where we started, is looking at those Common Core standards. What are the parts that you like about it? What are the parts you don't like about it? Let's discuss the ones we don't, and let's change them so we can all agree. Is that pretty much what happened? So that's why it's aligned, and that's why pretty much we can get caught up in the semantics of Common Core assessments or curriculum over on another side, but we've pretty much adopted the Common Core standards, having looked at them line item by line item, and the parts that we didn't agree with, we did make those changes, the standards. And I guess what I'm saying is, I hear a lot of folks get caught up in the standards when really they really mean to talk about assessments and or the curriculum. So, I mean, I guess I'm hearing saying that we pretty much adopted the Common Core standards with some slight variation, and our teachers from Alaska throughout have really line item by line item checked those standards out.
Representative Gaddis, I think that let's just see how to respond. What we've heard as essential is our state's right to do whatever our state wants to do with its standards. And so anytime we say we adopted the Common Core, there is an element of that is connected to giving up our rights to do what we want to do with our standards. And unequivocally, we did not do that, and we don't want to do that. Now, when one compares our standards with the Common Core standards, if we go to third grade math, for example, and look to see what kids are doing with multiplication facts, they are going to be Alaska third grade math standard, Common Core third grade math standard, individual standard, identical. Next standard, identical. Next standard, changed it up a little bit with some additional wording for clarity. So it's a tricky nuance in that we want to be very clear that we did not and we do not want to give up our right to do what we want. And the phrase adopted the Common Core implies a giving up of that right. So if we're talking about the standards themselves, grade by grade, and their degree of similarity to the Common Core, they are very similar standards with some language added in some cases for clarification, with some additional standards added in that Alaskans wanted retained that are not in the Common Core standards.
And if I might just follow up, thank you. That very well said, and that's what I want. And I'll admit that there's a lot of folks that are really pushing back against Common Core. They pretty much agree, and if they're listening or going to listen, they've agreed that the standards are far more rigorous. They've not found anything within the standards that they really have a problem with. So I guess I just really wanted to make sure, and you did a great job of separating the Common Core issues that people are fighting from actually what Alaska did and what Alaska is still allowed to do. And I think that's very, very important, so I thank you.
Representative Drummond. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. McCauley. A few minutes ago, you mentioned that if Alaska had adopted the Common Core standards whole cloth, that would have restricted our ability to make changes beyond 15%. Would you say there's a percentage difference? Can you say that the standards that we adopted are, say, 65% different from the Common Core standards? Is there a way to assess them, the changes that were made, or that the new standards that were introduced on Alaska's behalf differ from the Common Core standards?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Drummond. My understanding is that it wasn't that the rules around the adoption of Common Core were not that a state could change 15%, it was that they could add 15% and could change 0%. Mm-hmm. If we are constituting, the addition of clarifying language is a change, and certainly the addition of a standard that's not in the Common Core is a change, our standards are probably about 90% similar to the Common Core standards. If we compare every grade, K-12, every standard, we are probably talking about 90% similar. But that would not have been permitted had we adopted the Common Core. It wasn't 15% change. It was no change, addition of 15%. So even that little bit of difference, which actually wasn't a little bit to Alaskan educators, when we're talking about clarifying language on a literature standard that talks about culturally relevant reading materials, that's not a small thing to Alaskan educators. When we're talking about, as I've already said, a third grade standard around a reading skill and the words with scaffolding or support, a child will do this with scaffolding or support, that is not a small change to Alaskan educators. Those changes would not have been permitted.
Thank you.
President Josephson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. McCauley, I guess I'm a little, I'm far from an expert on Common Core. I got some sense that someone in the education community thought I was. I'm definitely not. But I looked at it a little bit online. It appears to be not a federal program, but a governor's organization, in part. It's not something the federal government created or is pushing, as I understand it. And it's also voluntary. And I'm just curious about what, if you could describe, and I really am expressing some ignorance of this, what is the national obsession about Common Core? Are we feeling pressure to join from our sister states? Why are we so focused on this? Why do we care?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, there were two organizations that were the leading organizations around the development of the Common Core state standards. The Council of Chief State School Officers, CCSSO, and the National Governors Association. That was a bipartisan effort, not driven by the federal government, regarding the development of the Common Core standards. So your statement was correct. Where things seem to have shifted a bit is when the language around the adoption of college and career-ready standards was included as one of the conditions of the ESEA waiver, then connecting that language, college and career-ready, to federal government through the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. And there, the best that I've been able to make sense of this is that that is when what was a bipartisan, non-federally driven effort became then connected to the federal government. The adoption of the Common Core standards are entirely voluntary. We've not felt at any point any pressure to do that. We don't now feel any pressure to do that. We are not the only state to have not adopted the Common Core standards and to have received an ESEA waiver. There is one other. There are two other states whose waivers are currently in review who have not adopted the Common Core standards. So my sense of it is a real resistance to and concern about anything that approaches what we're all hearing about, federal overreach of the federal government into education in the state of Alaska. And what we're trying to explain is, again, that both on the front end of what we've done and on the back end now of what we are able to do at any point, that has not, in our view, occurred. We were already out in front on two of the three required elements for that waiver. We would have done them with or without the waiver. The standards were adopted prior to our applying. They allowed us. They made it likely we would qualify for the waiver, but our doing them was not with a pressure or because of the waiver. That's I don't know if I've answered your question. I'll just stop. And if I haven't, then I'll attempt to do so.
Just a quick follow-up. I'm not sure. I think you explained it fine, but I just didn't get it. You talked about how there was some linkage with the ESEA and the Federal Department of Education, and I'm not sure I quite got that. But what I do hear you saying a couple times is that this is just not a federal program, and it sounds, Dr. McCauley, like you believe this is not, to the extent you believe in the concept of federal overreach, and if you don't, that's fine with me because I'm one of those who says it's overstated. But this is not, in your opinion, an example of federal overreach.
It is not, in my opinion,
okay.
Representative Josephson. And one of the things that I think is really critical to keep bringing back into this conversation is the degree to which these new standards are an increase in rigor and an increase in recognizing what it's really going to take for kids to be ready for college in the workplace. So I think we would be in error if we don't talk about our new standards in comparison to our previous standards. We're talking about things like nonfiction text. Our previous standards strongly emphasized fiction. Our new standards strongly emphasize fiction, good literature in the classroom. They also strongly emphasize nonfiction text, which was weak in our old standards. Kids go into college in the workplace, they are reading far more informational text than literature, than fiction. Our previous standards were weak in that area. We are hearing from the university all the time about the remediation rates in our university system. So part of the conversation has to be, in my opinion, the comparison of our new standards to our previous standards, and that these are, again, in my opinion and in the opinion of the educators who worked on developing the standards, a significant improvement from our old grade level expectations.
And I want to clarify, I think the federal government, where they became involved, and I think put red flags up for people, is the two consortiums were put out there with federal funding. You know, they both got a lot of federal funding up to, I think it's about to end, and so there's some concern about once the federal government quits doing that, if we're part of it, no matter what part we might be, are we going to be, you know, funding it as portion of that? And then Race to the Top, and that's one reason I think the state of Alaska didn't, as a state, didn't take any Race to the Top, is because you had to adopt the Common Core to qualify for it. So although they weren't at the beginning of it, they kind of muddied the waters because of the basically sticking out some carrots out there and maybe in hopes to have, you know, national standards. I'm not saying they did it for the wrong reasons. But once they started funding the consortium, that both consortiums that way, and then the Race to the Top, you had to adopt the Common Core. You couldn't just have a good program and ask for the money. I think who adopted it got way lost in that. But I wanted to ask, I just wanted to confirm one thing. When we're talking about local control, and now we're talking about curriculum, okay? And curriculum is the books, the materials you use to teach the standards. If these standards are more rigorous, are not most school districts going to have to not just review the curriculum they currently have, but most likely have to buy new books or supplements to be able to meet these new standards?
Representative Wilson, it is likely that some adjustments regarding curriculum and materials, it's not likely. There will need to be made adjustments to curriculum and materials in light of our new standards. How that's done and when it's done is a local decision. One of the things that we are trying to be very clear about is that, you know, the first time at which our new standards will be assessed is in 2015. This is not about a race to 2015 to shake everything up so that within a 24-month span of time, kids are proficient with regard to our new standards. It's to make good decisions about what changes need to be made to curriculum and materials, which will vary widely across the state. If, for example, a district adopted math materials 5 years ago, and this year is the sixth year on the curriculum review cycle, and math is up again, The timing's perfect. They are now going to consider the adoption of materials in terms of our new standards. And there is no automatic additional requirement there. They would have looked and said, how are our math materials cutting it? Do we need to supplement? Do we need to not use them anymore and adopt new ones? They will be doing that with our new standards. If a district adopted math materials 2 years ago, they are going to need to look at what they adopted and the degree to which they align with our new standards, and they will have some decisions to make around supplementing, around the degree to which they align. So same with curriculum documents, whether it's a scope and sequence or a curriculum map. They'll have to determine what the gaps are and fill those gaps. And in some districts, depending on what they've done, those gaps will be different than in others. But this is not about a rush to have all of that done by the first time our students are assessed. It's to move into the standards. It's to begin transitioning instruction toward them. It's to make good decisions at district levels for the system about what to do. And then when we assess for the first time in 2015, we will have information regarding how our students are doing that forms a new baseline. And then we determine, we and districts and schools determine, okay, now where are we going to go from there?
You want to try first or you want me to go? You go ahead, President Gaddis.
Well, you know, I mean, it begs the question, then where does the HSQE stand in this? Because if we're raising our standards, are we raising the HSQE, high school qualifying exam?
Well, under the current statute for the HSQE, including the intent language that was put in place with it, the HSGQE, I may not get my words exactly right because I haven't looked at that language for some time, but it is prescribed that it must be a test, a basic essential skills test of basic knowledge. Our new standards aren't basic knowledge. They're much more aspirational than that. So it is actually the time probably to have a discussion. We certainly have it at the department with the commissioner. I wouldn't be surprised if the commissioner has dialogue with the governor. I don't know that. I don't participate in those kinds of conversations. But is that really an exam that fits the new standards? The answer has to be absolutely no, because it's trying to make sure kids have the floor, not that they're ready to go to college. In many cases, districts actually do a very good job of figuring out that. Now, did they always do a good job? I don't know if they always did a good job. I think that test actually has fulfilled something of saying, folks, we've got to make sure these kids at least have those basic skills. But when we look at that test today and look at how many students are denied a diploma because of that alone and they're not already denied a diploma because they're credit short at the school district, very few students. So all I would describe around that is it's a timely discussion. It is one that we have at the department, but I don't know that we're at a position to say where we should take that in terms of a position. Might be in a different spot within a couple of months, because I think that is a dialogue that certainly is real timely this next legislative session.
But the waiver nor the federal funding is tied to that test.
Representative Wilson, that's correct, because it's completely state statute. Requirements, and there is no federal statute of a high school graduation qualifying exam.
Okay.
There isn't an exit exam requirement at the federal level. We are one of, I would guess, about somewhere in the range of 23 to 27 states that have some sort of exam exit requirement, but not all states have that.
Okay, and as we move into assessment, you know, I guess I differ with Dr. McCauley, because although there is local control for them to pick and choose what curriculum they want, that is only to the extent that it can match the standards that we have adopted. So, you know, I know there's I don't know where Anchorage is at on it, and I'm sure they're not much, probably where Fairbanks is right now. But Fairbanks, just to keep up, they try to do I believe it's, and I'm sure I'll hear from the superintendent because I'm probably wrong, but around every 5 or 6 years, they try to change, you know, the math curriculum and then the social studies. They kind of have everything on it. And, you know I have heard from them that they don't feel there's been any kind of assessment done by districts to go to them and say, how many of your subjects, or just these subjects alone, do you believe cannot meet these standards and you need new curriculum? Because if they're not teaching from the right books to go with the standards, it's going to show up on the assessments and they're going to get docked, whatever point system that we choose to do, because the books don't match. So, you know, I guess you're kind of given the impression that it's completely local control, and with the research I've done, it's all state control, and we choose. And it's going to sound really bad, and my constituents are going to hate me for this, but the way I, you know, law has determined it for us and shown us is that the state has chosen to give it to local communities, believing local control is the best, only if then at the end of the day through assessments or whatever, you know, we, you know, the department and the state board determines that criteria that they have to meet. So it's not like they can just do like a private school whatever they want. So I don't want to leave this meeting to make people feel like they're going to sit, you know, Fairbanks is going to sit down and look at their math books and say, well, they're close enough. Because if they're, you can't be close enough. I mean, am I wrong? I mean, they have to, they're going to analyze it, but if they're far off, you can't tell me the department isn't going to say anything and say, well, you're close enough and we'll just see how the testing works for you.
Representative Wilson, I certainly don't mean to give the impression that districts can do whatever they want with regard to ensuring alignment with the standards. It is expected that curriculum and materials are aligned with the state's adopted standards. The way districts go about, I also, however, saying that, don't want to imply that the way districts go about having alignment doesn't vary greatly across the state. It varies greatly across the state. I'll give one example for the sake of illustration. I'm thinking about North Slope Borough School District. Their curriculum is called the Inupiaq Learning Framework. They have a curriculum design process where the drivers are Alaska standards and the Inupiaq Learning Framework, developed locally and exclusively existing in the North Slope Borough School District. From there, with those two pieces of content as the drivers, then they develop unit plans. That is very different than happening anyplace, than is happening anyplace else in the state, and exclusively North Slope. So while, yes, curriculum and materials need to be aligned to the standards, there is still a lot of autonomy and a lot of variation across the state with how that looks. And I don't want to underemphasize how varied it is across the state. But, yeah, there are also, as we'll get into with both the assessment pieces here and the accountability pieces, there are expectations. Our new accountability system, thankfully, allowed us to set those expectations with some parameters, of course, but it's a lot different than adequate yearly progress. But there are expectations and targets for student achievement that are consistent across the state and are based on assessments which are assessing proficiency with our new standards.
So I guess, you know, the question is, did the department go to the districts, to the superintendents, and ask them why they're doing this review and during some of this public comment of how far off do you think that your curriculum is and how much it would cost you to be able to meet these standards? Because it's all connected. And I love choice. Don't get me wrong. Because you said the whole thing, they chose to do this part with the standards over here, but you get into these bigger districts and you just don't kind of have some of that choice. But, you know, I'm curious whether we did anything with Fairbanks or Anchorage and say, you know, what's it going to cost to, you know, which ones work and how much do you think this is going to cost you?
Again, Les Morse, Deputy Commissioner. There was actually, I think, pretty significant engagement of local districts. Does that mean that they completely agree that, you know, the costs, I think they had a balance, do the costs outweigh the benefits and vice versa in doing this. But as we were working on the engagement of Alaska stakeholders, and particularly when we go with engaged teachers, we actually reach out to all the superintendents to ask them to bring teachers to the table for this work. So clear back when we're developing the standards, which you put new standards in place, it's going to drive curriculum decisions locally, they were involved. Then when we were approaching the completion of those standards, we clearly kept the superintendents involved and in the loop in terms of talking about how different these are, that these really are different. It will require a change in the type of instruction needed, materials needed. The commissioner actually engages superintendents quite regularly, and we actually are hosting a meeting of superintendents, which we do every year this coming Monday. Last year, during this same meeting that we hosted superintendents, we talked about the recent adoption, the kind of work we were going to do to support professional development in the districts through these statewide meetings that we hold twice a year, we've been holding for several years, around supporting them on what kind of tools you might need to do the alignment of materials. So again, they were very much in the loop a year ago. In addition, a year ago, we talked about the overall concept of the waiver and actually sought their feedback at that time. So yes, they were involved, but you're also right, it shifts. It's just, if they were in a review cycle, the timing might be right, but all of a sudden with the adoption of these standards, they might say, boy, we adopted math 2 years ago, but now it's time to revisit math. There may be some real difficult choices in that. They might say, okay, we're going to review math again this year, which may have some costs, because that has costs. We were planning to do social studies, but we're not. We're not going to do that. That would be probably the choice I would make if I had have to think about efficiency of resources, because there's nothing driving that change. So, yes, the standards are driving the change, but the decision does get to be made locally. But so I wouldn't want to walk away and say there's no cost to it. I would say if they want to keep all their review cycles going the same way and then add these, there'd be added costs. I think many of the districts are saying we're going to have to trade out what we review on this cycle, and therefore the costs might be nearly the same, but the timing would be different of things. Tough decisions that have to be made.
Moving on to assessments.
Yeah, let's and hopefully this will answer some more questions, but we'll probably leave all of the room with some questions when I finish this that will hopefully be answered in the coming months. So the first piece is, once we adopted the new standards, you typically don't want to test to the new standards as soon as you adopted them. You want to actually provide time for implementation. So we knew that as soon as we adopted those standards in June of 2012, there ought to be a period of time before you begin assessing those new standards. The truth is you need to leave time so people just become aware of what action took place. So last year, we actually did a lot of work around awareness of the new standards and started getting into transitioning from the prior standards to the new standards. Right now, we're working with many districts on that transition and moving into the implementation, actually implementing those new standards so that they begin that process by 2015. But actually, the real important year will be the year after, when you have the second assessment. You begin to look at, how much did kids grow from the first time they took that assessment to the second time they took that assessment? So we wanted to have an implementation lag in terms of the assessment. The second thing that I want to bring up is that there will be necessary regulatory changes, but there won't be any new regulations necessary. So let me explain what I mean by that. We currently have a document that we have to adopt in regulation called the Participation Guidelines. It indicates how do special education students get to take this assessment without invalidating the assessment. That's the accommodations guidelines. Well, as we look at any new assessment, you might have to change the accommodations guidelines, because you look at each assessment, determine what accommodations you can give that don't invalidate the assessment. So we'll have to probably have a new accommodations guideline. But it won't be a new regulation, it will be an updated regulation. The other types of things that are in regulations is what grade levels do we test at? If we chose to test at 11th grade versus 10th grade, we'd have to make a shift there. We also have things like what the security rules are well, if we did some testing or all testing online, but maybe even just in some districts did online testing, the security rules might need a change. So again, I want to reiterate, we don't anticipate new regulations. We anticipate updating regulations. One of the questions that I've been asked that I hope add a lot of clarity around is, so what will be traded out as a result of this? And what tests will we still have to give, and who requires those tests? I hope this chart that I have up now.
And what happens if we don't?
And what happens if
we always have that choice of not to.
Exactly. And then there'll be, we'll go over the funding implications of don't at the end. But that's a little, well, we'll get to that part at the end in terms of the funding. So first let me just describe the orientation of this chart. Let me start with saying the assessments that will be traded out because of these standards are the standards-based assessments, often referred to as SBAs, in reading, writing, and mathematics. Not science, because we didn't change the science standards. Also,
On the science test, because the consortiums were talking about just reading and math, what will you use for science? You still use the same SBAs you use now?
Representative Wilson, that's correct. We've continued doing our current assessment, which is it's currently a standalone booklet given to three grade levels, 4, 8, and 10, I think. I'm not sure about 4, actually. I think it might be 5. We made it, I think NAEP is given in fourth grade, so we chose to not give it in a grade NAEP was given. So I believe it's in 5 and 8. So that will continue to be given. So I put in red, if you have this in color, the things that would change, and it's the top two assessments. In addition to the standards-based assessment, the alternate would have to change because the alternate is an assessment for students with significant cognitive disabilities who are unable to take the standards-based assessment. It's a very small group of students, about 600 or 700, I would guess. I'm guessing that number. And it's designed, everyone takes a standards-based assessment unless you can't. So students who are usually severely cognitively disabled. So those are the two assessments that would change out. So the way I've laid this table out is what the assessment's called, who takes the assessment is the middle column, and who requires that. And I basically abbreviated those requirements with just the overall law. So in that final column, you'll see it's either required by the Elementary Secondary Education Act, or you'll see it's required, or and maybe, in the first case it's or and, Alaska statute, and in one case, Alaska Administrative Code, which means it's state regulation adopted by the state board. So those first two assessments are our accountability assessments used to drive the accountability system. Those two would change out. We have to change them if we want to test our new standards. So if we chose not to change them and stay with those, we actually would be testing standards that no longer are required to be taught. We'd be have new standards of which we wouldn't have a test for. That would be one implication, which so if people actually move and begin teaching the new standards, but in 2015 we still test using the old assessment, we actually will have a mismatch between what's taught and what's being assessed. The other piece that would be a requirement is we would lose the waiver, because the waiver was contingent on adopting college and career-ready standards and then putting an assessment in place that assesses that. And we'll get into more clarity around the waiver, but in many ways what it does is the waiver did allow us to drive forward something Alaska preferred and got out of some federal oversight in terms of a system that we had no voice in, and we would have to go back to all the No Child Left Behind rules that previously existed. The other assessments listed on here are ones that, actually you saw a more detailed table, and I know you see a lot of things during session, but one of the things I presented at subcommittee at one time was a more detailed table like this. and it goes over all of the assessments and who requires them. So I'm not going to go into those unless at the end of the assessment section there are specific questions around those.
Representative Reinbold, I know I broke my own rules too, so go ahead. Okay, I just want to know, teachers are constantly complaining they have too many days testing. I mean, this doesn't look like much less testing to me. So I'm just wondering, is there any possibility of limiting some of these other tests that they're complaining about?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, well, the Elementary Secondary Education Act requires those top four.
Mm-hmm.
So if we continue to participate in the Elementary Secondary Education Act, you need to do those top four. And the very first one is in Alaska statute also. So at the end of the presentation, we'll talk about the dollars connected to this and the implications of dollars of not participating. But clearly, we can't choose not to participate in those. The developmental profile is actually less of an assessment in terms of sit down and give kids a test. It's actually something teachers generally give as the students are new to them. So it's given to kindergarten students and new first grade students. And often they structure it in such a way that it teachers actually really appreciate this. It helps them get to know their learner as they're coming in. So that one, well, it may, I don't see that one as burdensome and duplicative of any grades. The high school graduation qualifying exam is a test completely under state statute. It's required by state statute, not by federal statute. We talked about it a little bit earlier. Is it the time to have that discussion? And it may be. And then work keys is an assessment given because the state board put that requirement forward, but in part because it qualifies students for the career portion of the Alaska Performance Scholarship. So that's what drives them. I am not on any of the policy boards or in the legislature where you make the decisions as to what should go forward. The one I do think is probably timely to discuss is the qualifying exam, but that's probably a greater discussion both at the administrative level as well as during the legislative session.
But the standards-based assessment, we're not required to do that every year. We choose to do that every year. Is that not correct?
You're required to do that under ESEA.
Every year?
Every year, yes.
And so is the English language proficiency, is that every year 3 through 10 as well?
You're correct. That's actually K-12, and it's only students who are limited English proficient. So it's the last time I worked in the assessment world was about 5 years ago, but we were testing around 17,000 students of our 130,000 students on that assessment. So it's only limited English proficient students take that particular assessment.
And do those same 17,000, that just seems like an awful lot, also take the whatever testing that we choose for the standards-based assessment? Or do they only take the English language proficiency?
They take both assessments because there are two different purposes behind them. The one is to determine whether they have made progress in terms of learning the English language. The other one is to test their content knowledge. So the English language proficiency assessment assesses language proficiency. Are you able to speak, write, read, and comprehend English better? It doesn't test the content knowledge.
No, I understand that, but if I can't speak or understand English very well, so I'm taking the English language proficiency, odds are that I'm not going to do very good. Well, yeah, I'm trying to watch my own English very well on the standards-based assessment because the other one already proved that I don't have what I need to get up to the next one.
Representative Wilson, I don't disagree with you a bit, and actually I'll give you a little more history behind this. So first off, the requirement they take that other assessment, it's required, but if they are not proficient in the English language, they get accommodations just as a student who is in special education gets accommodations. So they do get an accommodated test. The second piece is, we don't completely disagree with you. We actually went to the U.S. Department of Education and requested a waiver from those kids having to take the test at least until their 3 years of instruction in the English language. That was denied. What we do have is students who take the standards-based assessment, who are limited English proficient, who are new immigrants to the country, for a particular number of years, I think it is two, they must take the assessment, but we don't have to account those results in the accountability system. So it's a federal requirement to receive the federal funding under ESEA, and that's where it's.
And how many days is that testing?
Do you remember the English language proficiency length? There are four subtests. They're not as long as a standards-based assessment. So I would envision for groups of students, and sometimes you give them to smaller groups, that it occupies part of four different days, but it would be a limited part of 4 days, if I'm remembering that one correctly.
I have a question.
Go ahead, Representative Wilson.
Are all of those English language proficiency students, do they all have IEPs?
No, not necessarily. There may be some that would have IEPs because they're also in special education, but what they typically have is a learning plan, and that learning plan outlines the kinds of things that would be accommodations they'd receive on the test, as well as the kind of things that the general education teachers would need to provide in terms of support for that student to be successful on the content within instruction. So technically, it's not an IEP that has the contractual types of things with it that are required under the special education law, but there are individual plans for those students.
Do those plans go along when they do the standards based assessment?
Representative Wilson, yes, they do that. That plan describes what accommodations that limited English proficient student would receive.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Reinbold.
Thank you, Chairwoman. Okay, basically what my question is I've been to an education meeting recently, and I believe they said that there were 17 days of testing throughout the school year from state, federal, district, and things like the Terra Nova. There's just a lot of, and now, of course, this is going to be this new assessment, the PARC or Smarter Balance. So we're just trying to figure out when are the teachers, just to maximize their time in the classroom to educate rather than just test all the time. So where does Terra Nova fall into all this? And is there anything as legislators you need us to look into to allow the teachers more freedom to educate rather than just test all the time?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, the Terra Nova, which is not on this list, the State Board removed that requirement. So that was one that could be removed based on the interpretations from the Attorney General's office. The State Board then said, let's remove it, because the governor, as you'll recall, in last year's State of the State said he's asked the State Board to look at tests we could get rid of that were outdated. So we've eliminated that one. I don't know that I would say there's 17 days of testing, because if I were an English language proficient, if I were a limited English proficient student.
Wait, let's make you a fourth grader or an eighth grader, mm-hmm. so that you're going to count in the NAEP test, because you got caught up in, it was your lucky day to do the NAEP.
Okay, my lucky day.
Your lucky day. You get every test that comes about. So you get to do the NAEP, the English language proficient, and the standard-based assessment that year.
So I think I may have 9 days of testing then.
And so if we had the Terra Nova before, that may have come now that we have just, I mean, it's been just like the last year in which that finally went off the books. A couple meetings ago, I believe, actually.
3 days.
Right. But if I'm in fourth grade and had to take the NAEP, I wouldn't take the Terra Nova. We clearly made sure that the Terra Nova and the NAEP were not on the same year because of that reason. So I understand. I taught for 11 years. I was a principal for 6. I didn't love testing. But I just don't want to say it's more than it is, and I can't get 17 days. I can get 9. I get 9 days if I'm taking all the tests
mm-hmm.
in a grade. I don't come up with a combination of more than that. But that doesn't make it any better, because in addition to the state-required assessments, many districts add some requirements. And so 17 might not be the wrong number when you add other local assessments that get added to that. So I wouldn't want to say that's wrong, because a teacher's going to look at, they don't care who required it. They're going to look at their whole year and how many days they're taking tests. So that might be an accurate number given by some teacher in a district in Alaska.
Director Reinbold.
Thank you. It, just through the chair, just one more follow-up question. When did the Terra Nova, was it this year?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Reinbold, the state, it was still given this year. The state board considered that regulation throughout the winter during legislative session. It was out for public comment, so it was adopted, I think, in April, so that it could take effect by the time the school year begins and it not become a requirement in this next school year.
Good. Okay, thank you very much.
Assessment always brings out lots of questions. So let me drive on to the next slide.
There's too much of it. We're trying to figure out how to make it less.
Yeah, and I understand that. And actually, I hope this table's that table that we're going to leave, I hope that's helpful because it shows you where the driver is behind it in terms of the law. So you have a new assessment. You have new standards. You have to have a new assessment. Otherwise, you have a mismatch.
Mm-hmm.
So we really viewed there are probably three options. And actually, I want to also bring up that we've heard from you that how do our students do compared to the rest of the country? So we're trying to figure out, well, what can we do on an assessment? Doesn't mean there's only one choice to do that, but what choice could we put forward that says, how do our kids compare in terms of being ready in Alaska compared to students in Washington or some other place? So we are in tune to that. And then, actually, at the last meeting during the legislative session, I had talked about one of these options, which is the Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortium, and actually mentioned that we had just received this independent review of our standards that said we could, if we wanted to, participate in that assessment. I also said at that meeting, we haven't said we will. We now just have that option, and we're keeping that option open for a little while longer. So I'm going to go through the three options we think that we have. The first one is to join one of two assessment consortiums. I'll talk about those, what they are, in just a moment. Or build our own assessment, which is an option, what we have right now. We did a custom-built assessment. And I'll tell you why we got there, by the way. 8 years ago, we built we used a published product by CTB McGraw-Hill. But the published product was not aligned to our standards, so we had to add to that test. And ultimately, then, when we wanted to shift, when we were required to go out to bid, a new company won the contract, but the old company owned the test, and they owned so many questions because it was their published product, we couldn't take them to the new vendor. So we made the decision at that time, the commissioner, three or four commissioners ago, said, we're going to build something, and we're going to own it. We're never going to get stuck in this spot again. That's how we ended up there. But today might be different. The economy and those kinds of things may tell us building your own assessment isn't the best option. So, but that's an option we ought to look at and figure out what it would cost. The third option is really to purchase a published assessment that exists, something that already is out there that is aligned to our standards. So those are the three options as we see it. I don't know of any other option. Someone knows one. We can put it in the pool and take a look. But whatever option we choose, if we want to continue to get funding through the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, we must prove that the assessment is aligned with our standards. Otherwise, you forfeit the Elementary Secondary Education Act funding or you take penalties. That's an absolute requirement.
And what are the penalties?
Sometimes what the penalties, typically the first penalty is conditions, and the conditions say you will have an assessment within this many years, and then there's monitoring, and that monitoring usually means some periodic level of monitoring to prove that we're on that path. So they usually start with conditions, and then you prove you're going to get there within a time frame. They also, Nebraska was in this situation, and I believe the threat before Nebraska said, okay, we're tired of fighting with you, is they made the choice to shift, but I believe they were going to withhold, and I'm doing this off of memory, I thought it was 20% of their ESEA funding, and at that point they said, we will move to an assessment, and they had to shift their entire program. Nebraska is the only one that had that level under the prior funding and assessment regime for No Child Left Behind. So what we're doing is actually we intend to put out a request for proposals, an RFP, in the very near future. And what we intend to learn from that and actually maybe even lock in a vendor is one of three things. First off, if you participate in an assessment consortium, and we are advisory only, not governing, with the Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortium, there are certain things they provide at a cost, and I'm going to go over the costs in a little bit, a little more. And then there are certain things you still need to pay for. In other words, you get your items from the consortium. You even get a test from the consortium. But they don't administer the test to your students, and they don't bring the test back and score them, and they don't then produce score reports to go to parents and families. So you have to get a vendor to do that. So there's certain things they provide, certain things you still need a vendor for. We're calling those wraparound services. You wrap it around the services you get from the consortium. So we're going to ask to try to get three pieces of information in this one RFP or go multiple routes to get the information if we have to. We want to find out, so what would those wraparound services cost? That way we know, is this an efficient approach and does it make sense? What does it cost to completely build our own assessment, just like we have now, aligned to our standards? So we can find out. I've guessed, based on history of building our last assessment and inflation proving it, but I don't know that that guess is right. The best way to find out if that's right, put a request for proposals out. And then the third choice is, are there published products that a vendor could say, yes, it's aligned to your standards, and here's how we'll prove it to you, and this is how we can show how your students compare to other students nationally, because that's a question people want to know. So we hope to put the RFP out in probably the third to fourth week in August. This is a big RFP, and many states are actually going out to RFP right now to lock down their vendors for 2015. So we want to have a good response, so we anticipate a six-week window on that. That way we give time to actually, I'll just tell you the first time we did an RFP in this line when I was at the department, it was two very thick binders full of information. It takes a lot of work for a company to put these together, so it will take that long. So I anticipate that going out, though, in the probably around the third week of August. And so when we get that information back and score those, we'll learn about the quality of vendors available and the efficiency or maybe lack thereof of doing any one of those options. Another piece that is important is technology readiness. And so we're actually engaging in a process with our current test vendor who does do online testing in other states, not in ours, to determine if we had to do a test using technology, how ready are we? And right now we're using information from the Work Keys assessment, which is online in many districts, not all but most. We are using information that districts supply through their application for E-rate, which tells us broadband and tells us how many machines they have. We're then going to add to that an actual tool that allows the district to turn on every one of their machines and actually go online to a tool that our vendor has that will check the readiness, whether that machine could run an assessment that we anticipate coming out. And the reason we have to do this is not only are these consortium products online, but commercial products, one tool in particular called Aspire that's being developed by ACT that Alabama has decided that they were going to use, it's an online assessment. So almost any direction you go now, you really need to figure out whether you could do that. If it is online, your price comes down because the paper pencil is very expensive. You have to produce the paper pencil. You have to ship it all over. That adds a lot of cost. We may find that what we're in a situation in Alaska, though, is that we're giving some online, some paper pencil. We're going to just work to see where we're at with that as we move that forward.
Richard Reinbold?
Really, a question in regards to this. You said we have not adopted Common Core. We've adopted the Alaska standards, which are about 90%. To maintain state control, it just seems logical to build our own test. I know that you're trying to figure that out, if that's right, because when I was at NCSL in Denver a couple months ago, they said that we would be, if we adopted the Smarter Balance, we would be writing our checks to UCLA. I specifically asked the vendor, and that's what they said. As a state government, we would be writing, you know, our checks to them because they would be the person, you know, coordinating these efforts. So I'm sure some of the people in the legislature may have a challenge with that. So can you give an estimate? You said that you may have one. That's why you're going to do an RFP of what it would cost for the state so we can maintain control, so we can maintain that diversity across the state.
If I could answer that when I get to slide 11,
okay.
I think that answers that question.
Go ahead, continue.
And I'll go a little bit deeper based on your question about that.
Hopefully this isn't that deep. What is our deadline that we have to, what's the date deadline that we have to have an assessment in place? Or at least tell them, here's who we're going to have, and we're moving down that road.
Well, if we're going to build our own assessment, we should have had it in place a year ago. We should have been on that path a year ago. We could probably do it. I don't know that we could get it built by 2015.
But when do we have to have one? What's that drop dead date?
What's the first time it'll be
for
used?
The spring of 2015 is when we need an assessment.
Is there a specific date?
We usually give it in the spring.
Oh,
so
okay.
When do we have to have it in place?
Okay.
It depends on the type of product you use. If you're building your own, you really – I built a test in 14 months, and anyone who is teaching in 2005 will remember how miserable that was.
I guess my point is – according to to the federal government, if you will, they haven't put a specific date that you have to have a test. You just have to have it a test ready by spring.
By
that
spring
aligns.
2015.
Got it. Okay.
So the next slide is I'm going to just dig a little bit deeper into SBAC because we're advisory. Again, I want to be clear. We haven't made the decision, but the decision does have to come pretty soon. Because there's a lot of work to getting ready to give an assessment. So SBAC stands for Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortium. It's one of two consortiums that are out there. You'll hear news about both consortiums. Matter of fact, news on PARC came out this week, and theirs costs more per student than what the SBAC one would cost. I'll be getting into costs, like I said, on slide 11. We chose the SBAC option because it was closer aligned to our current program. It has a summative assessment very much like what we currently do. We had to, though, to be able to adopt or be able to use or be able to be a member of that consortium, we had to show that our standards were sufficiently aligned to what's being developed. We had to have a third party do that work, so we had a third party do it called the Council of Chief State School Officers, who actually helped develop the Common Core, and so it made sense to go to someone who really knows the Common Core to say, well, what's the same and what's different. There's not exact alignment, but there is sufficient alignment to say that if you use that assessment, you would be able to warrant results that are going to be appropriate. The other thing is Alaska chose to become a member as advisory versus governing. It's because there's more future obligations in governing. There's a greater commitment in governing, and we weren't ready to make that commitment. But the only way to really find out what's going on is to get access into the door to the meetings, and that's what advisory allowed us to do. Now I learn about SBAC nearly every day in my emails. Prior to becoming advisory, we didn't know what they were doing. So this just allowed us to learn what's going on so we could make a decision. A little bit more about Smarter Balanced. There are pricing structures that would allow you to participate just on the summative assessments, which is what the state does right now. There's also a pricing structure that says you could do more than that. We don't know whether we would do more than that or not. Let me just talk about what those two things are. A summative assessment is, again, it's in grades 3 through 8 and grade 11. A state could choose to add grade 9 and 10 if the state chose, but the tests that are being made that would actually meet the requirements of the Elementary Secondary Education Act requirements are in grades 3 through 8 and 11. Why 11? They tried to pick something closer to being exiting from high school so that they could really do a determination on are you college and career ready. Feeling 10th grade is a bit early for that decision. And actually, spring of 12th grade often is too late for a couple of reasons. Once kids have chosen what college they're going to and made that decision, they're not going to take a test in high school all that seriously. The other piece is you still have some time to do something if you take the test in 11th grade. And so there were some specific reasons for choosing 11th grade. the comprehensive assessment, similar to our current assessment program. It's computer-based and adaptive. Adaptive is a new term, so let me just describe quickly what it means. Adaptive means the student, when they take this assessment, if they're doing it on the computer, they take a few items that are the same as every student taking that grade-level test, and then it determines how well is that student doing, and it either, if they're getting all those items right, the items then get progressively more difficult. So the test not only determines what grade level they're at, or, excuse me, whether they're proficient at the grade level they're taking the test for, but what would this student actually be proficient if they moved into the next grade level or more difficult items? Does the same for if a student gets all those wrong, it's going to actually go to less difficult questions, so you'd be able to say the student is not proficient and they appear to be performing about a grade level behind. That's what adaptive does. That's one of the things that is allowed by a test that many of our districts choose to give called the MAPS, the Measure of Academic Progress. So many districts give that. That's an adaptive test. The paper-pencil version obviously won't have that. The paper-pencil will be available under SBAC for only 3 years, and it does come at an extra cost. The state would have to pay those costs. The idea behind this is that it be college and career ready. So you work closely with your university, you work with career type programs with the intent that if a student is proficient, that ought to suffice that all things being equal, which lives of young people is not all things being equal always, they would be able to go into credit bearing courses at the college or into certificate programs at your trade schools. And so we've worked very closely with those as we develop the standards, as we move into any assessment, whether it be this one or one of our own or a published product, we'd want to work closely with the universities. That's the replacement program if you go with SBAC. The addition, which comes at an additional cost, which the state may or may not choose to bear. It may be if districts want to do this, then districts can pay to do this extra cost just like they do with the MAPS right now, which is an assessment districts choose to give, is these what are called interim and formative assessments. The interim ones are designed so that if you wanted to not wait till the end of the year to give an assessment, but you wanted to give one in the fall and one in the winter, you actually can get a, they're shorter, and you can get a picture of, is this student on track to do well on the assessment at the end of the year? And that's why districts give local assessments. The formative is actually tools that teachers would use maybe to give a very, very quick and short assessment in the classroom that actually tells them how on track are these kids on this, and literally would cause them to change instruction tomorrow because kids are off track.
Representative Drummond, did you have a question?
Yes, I did, Madam Chair. Thank you. On the computer-based adaptive tests, is whether a school district chooses to go with that dependent on adequate broadband access and the number of computer stations, or is it the, and if paper and pencil is that much more expensive, how many of our districts would be forced to spend more money on paper and pencil if they couldn't do the technology-based versions?
Through the chair, Representative Drummond. First off, in terms of how many, it really is going to depend on that technology readiness that I spoke of, the that piece. So we won't really know who is ready probably for a few months, and that's assuming they continue to keep their technology up, which districts are working always, of course, I think, to do. But so we'll learn that within a couple of months. Currently, we don't charge any costs to the district in terms of paper, pencil versus online if they go that option. WorkEase is a test that is one or the other, but WorkEase actually charges the same amount for both. I don't believe this will be that way. We'll learn that through that RFP also. But we currently don't charge the districts, and I don't know that the state would charge the districts if they go paper, pencil. I do know of another state that actually has asked all their districts to get technology ready, and if they aren't technology ready and they have to use paper pencil, the districts are going to have to pay for that paper pencil. I don't think that's a dialogue we've entered into in the state, and I don't think there would be much interest in that, but I might be wrong.
So
it would actually be an added cost for the state's contract with the assessment vendor.
Okay, so the state would absorb the cost if there was a difference.
That is the way I'm moving forward in the preparation of this and working with staff at the department to prepare that. But if it's another direction a decision made in the other direction, that hasn't been made at this time.
Thank you.
Representative Gaddis.
I can't help but hear you talk about costs and who's paying, things like that. At the end of the day, who makes the choice on which way we're going to go and how much we're going to spend?
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis. What we feel obligated as a state to give is the summative assessments, because that's what's required. If we actually found that the pricing of all of this, included this interim informative, could come in at what we're currently spending on assessment, well, we could make that choice to participate in that if the administration was comfortable with that. But we'd also probably want to have a lot of dialogue with the legislature, because that would be saying that we're now adding something to this that is a choice and not a statutory requirement. My guess is the summative will probably, I'll get more into price on the next slide. And
I wasn't sure if I got ahead of myself.
What I think we would probably do, based on my read of a crystal ball, is the summative is going to probably come in nearly the same price. So the formative is tools that the state has never bought before and probably wouldn't buy now, but we would make it available for districts to somehow do a license that they could get access to it. It's a little bit tricky, because if you're in these consortiums, they do work with states. They don't work with districts. So we'd have to figure out a fee structure, how that would work. But that could all be sorted out. That's just a technical issue.
And I guess here's the crux of my question. Is it possible that DEED could make a commitment for the state of Alaska for millions and billions of dollars without going through the legislature?
The only way that we could do that, not in additional dollars. If we went out to bid and we found out that the assessment was going to cost $250,000 more in 2 years out versus the current year, I think there would probably be some dialogue we'd have to have with the governor's office and OMB, but that's about the increases we've been dealing with our current assessment program. So I think our view would be to analyze that and say, well, that's not really out of line with where we were going with our current program. If it was a lot more than that, I think we'd have to be having some pretty heavy dialogue about that, because it's a much greater investment than what our current program is costing.
I think I'd like to remind the committee, your legislators, and you do the appropriation. So DEED could commit, and they could sign up on an RFP. They wouldn't have to come through us to sign the RFP, and they could do it for $20 million. But if they came before us next year for $20 million and we chose to give them $5 million, they would have to determine out of their own budget where they would get the $15 million. So we can't necessarily tell them what to sign or not to sign unless within statute, as the chair of the Education Committee might determine how they might want to do that. But as long as it says that the state is going to do the assessment, the department will decide how to do that assessment, sign what they believe with the governor on what they think we can swallow. But at the end of the day, it will determine on the budget process whether or not those dollars are given. And I think they're very aware of that. And I guess I just want to take a moment, too, with Representative Reinbold. A lot of this has come from our last few years from our committee as far as making their own test. And the concern from the committee previously has been not just making our own test, but making our own cut scores, in which many parents who have then moved to other states have found that their children do not perform at the same level. So to be fair with our ever-moving population, especially with the military we so love, especially Eielson, that I had to put in because she's going to house them if they move here, is that are we being fair to our children here if we don't ever have some type of testing in which we can do some type of comparison? So not that they couldn't go to doing their own, but I think this committee has been one of probably the most vocal ones on not being very happy that it just doesn't seem like, and the NAEP has kind of shown us that as well, that we are really bringing our children to a level in which we need to.
now. That doesn't mean we couldn't make our own tests and we couldn't have higher cut scores and make that happen, but that was the past.
Right, and I through the chair, I understand that, but I, you know, it would be nice to evaluate the percentage of students. I looked at a recent just snapshot, and it said about 2% of the people actually are moving out of the state, so I don't want to, you know, lose our state control for a handful of students that are leaving, you know, the state. I think it's really important that we maintain state control. And that would definitely be, you know, something that I would like looked at. And also they keep talking about this pencil and paper thing. Well, what about the cost of the computer and the broadband and all of that? Who's going to absorb the cost? I mean, in all these 53 districts, it's going to be extremely expensive to get this these computer-generated and computer assessments done. So, I mean, I think that's really, really important to assess the cost of that.
Well, it would be my intent to bring back the, you know, once they have that information and bring them back and find out whether or not there's a lot of districts that, I mean, it may come back that there's only a couple of districts. We may need to have that conversation with those legislators in those areas. So we'll put that on the calendar as soon as they get that to come back in and let us know what kind of readiness we're actually in.
I mean, that's really what we're trying to do is figure those things out. So the assessment costs, here's where I have laid these things out. So in terms of the assessment costs, if we went with the Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortium, is SBAC provides the assessments. So the items and the test engine for electronic testing and analysis is provided by that consortium. And they estimate that those costs would cost about $6.20 per student for the summative only assessment, not the formative added to it, the formative and interim. So about $6.20. Then you'd have to get a vendor who would be required for the wraparound services, which would include the administration of the assessment, the scoring of the assessment, the recording of the assessment, data analysis tools so that districts get all their data so they can take a look at results and those kinds of things. All the things that our current assessment program does that SBAC wouldn't do. Our current standards-based assessment costs us approximately $50.43 per student. We estimate, this is a broad estimate, and an RFP is a better way to get the costs, but we sat down, we looked, and we said, we had to do paper pencil, and we had to use our current vendor and what they charge in all these categories, and we lined that up. We literally lined up, here's what SBAC would do at their $6.20 per student. Here's everything that they don't do that a vendor charges. We looked at the current vendor charges that they charge us in those categories, and we came up with this could cost us $49.24 per student, about what we're paying right now, a little bit less, actually. So that's our guess. That's all that is a guess, because the only way you find out what the competitive market is to do a competitive process through an RFP. So that's what drove us to, let's do an RFP. That's the only way we can find this out. Now, earlier, Representative Reinbold asked about UCLA in particular. What happened is SBAC was a consortium of states. They came together, and they sought a federal grant through Race to the Top money. About $350 million went to two different assessment consortiums of Race to the Top money. That's about 10% of all the Race to the Top money went to those two consortiums. The rest went to states that applied. We did not. Their obligation was to build an assessment, but that grant ends in September 2014, on the last day of September 2014. So they had to figure out, well, what do we do after that if these states want to use this test? Well, what those states that are governing states in SBAC is actually went to say, well, where could we have this product land and charge us only $6.20 to run the program and build that assessment? And the decision by the governing states through some process they went through, we're not a governing state, so we didn't participate in that, was it will land at UCLA. Why UCLA? Well, it has a big education center there that does work around assessments. It's a place called, and sorry, I cannot remember the acronym. I wasn't prepared for this question, but it's called CREST, C-R-E-S-S-T, I think. And it's a division within UCLA. and they've been doing assessment work for years. Well, that's where the governing states of SBAC decided this could live, and the estimated cost of participating would be $6.20 per student. They actually estimate the whole cost of this assessment if you take your SBAC cost and your vendor cost and you do everything online at $20.50 per student. We think that's low, but maybe it's not. We'll find out through the RFP process. So that's what we know about SBAC and its costs and where it will, and that's how it landed at UCLA Crest, which is part of UCLA. But the RFP will give us the real information. And then lastly, I just want to share, what are the implications of the waiver? We adopted new standards. We had to adopt a new test. To get the waiver, we had to agree to test by 2015. That's the only thing we did in the waiver, is agree that we'd test in 2015. We thought maybe at one point we shouldn't test till 2016, giving us more years. So the one thing that we agreed to that we wouldn't have already agreed to is to test in 2015. We might have put it off till 2016. So that's the only waiver implication. So next we're going to get into educator evaluation. And we actually have two more components and then the pricing. So I mentioned that with just the chair.
Mr. Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me, Mr. Morse, if a state was sensitive about its sort of sovereign interests and its individualized approach to testing and assessment, it would be more sensitive about the standards in the assessment. Is that? I mean, at some point, if a governing body has an assessment, you can look at it and say, yep, that certainly tests the standards that we've prepared through the 229 stakeholders or whatever. That's the thing that you'd be more sensitive about, wouldn't you? Not you'd want to make sure the assessment was right, but assuming it was right, I'm just trying to think, is there an Alaska way? I suppose there would be with indigenous populations, but is there an Alaska way to assess the standard? It just seems like it's an assessment.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think the question really comes down to who owns the product at the end of the day, who can walk away with it, who can control the length and those kinds of things. The questions that we have, if we did a custom-developed test, would not look a lot different than the questions that SBAC is developing. Matter of fact, one of the contractors for developing items is a company called CTB McGraw-Hill. Well, they didn't have the capacity to do all the work themselves, so they subcontracted with a company called DRC, or Data Recognition Corporation. That's our test vendor. They've developed our items. They're now developing SBAC items. The items would be much the same regardless of what test you use. It's just who owns it. Does a consortium own it? Does the state own it? Or does a publishing company own it and you're leasing it? And I don't know about all the other feelings that are behind that. There may be lots of concerns, but that's my perspective on it. It's who owns it at the end of the day.
Go ahead, Representative Gaddy.
Quick question. And in this RFP, I assume that for special ed and so on, that the testing will be more costly. I'm just making that assumption. But are you addressing that in the RFP?
For, through the chair, Representative Gaddis, for students who are in special education who take this as the regular assessment, I would actually say those costs are costs that probably wouldn't be different than they are now, but they're locally borne costs of actually trying to do accommodations for lots of different students. So those costs will be much the same as what they are now, and there are costs behind that, but it's locally.
But you are addressing that, and when you go out with the RFP, you're asking what that'll cost.
Right. Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, in terms of what that vendor costs are and in terms of the work they would have to do in terms of any different type of scoring because of how that's accommodated, yes, that's correct.
Question, Rangel?
Okay. And this is a little bit of a complicated question, but teachers oftentimes will test to an assessment, not necessarily to a standard. And I'm hoping that you as a state board will be making sure that they are the standards, not the assessment, so the teachers don't get caught up with the assessment. Well, let's just have a question right now. Like, let's say you adopt or the state adopts standards that are very anti-development standards, and then there's tests where you have to, you know, on the test, the students are tested on the assessment, and they have to answer accordingly to the standards. I guess what my bottom line question is, in a state that is very pro-development, I've seen some of the proposed standards for science, and they were not in alignment with what some of our jobs are, current jobs are in the state of Alaska. So the assessment is concerning to me, and making sure that the standards do align with the assessment and that the teachers don't end up testing to this national standard that may not really truly allow these students to become ready for the jobs. So is there going to be some sort of an evaluation system through the board that the standards are very much aligned with what the jobs are available in this state so that the career and job-ready people can actually, you know, get jobs up here? And I hope I made myself clear. I know we're in a long roundabout way, but
you know,
I think you're getting...
If I might, I'm going to pitch in here because I think I know what she meant, but I got to tell you, it sounded interesting. And what I think that she meant is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that there are standards, and I think she used the word standard at times that she may have meant assessment. And so what I think that if we have science standards, what I think she wants to, I don't want to speak for you, but I think as a resource development state, we always want to be aware that we never teach differently than what our values of this state are. And as a resource development state, we certainly don't want to go into another territory that is foreign to what our values as a state are. I think that's where she was going with that question. And if I might piggyback on that same question, there's a challenge that we would teach to a test, and there are tests that I take and I can think of as a pilot. I want somebody to teach me what's on the test because ultimately I want to pass the test so I can continue flying. So, you know, teaching to the test has a bad connotation, but at the same time, if I need to pass the test, I would beg that the teachers teach me what's on the test. So two things, our values that the state of Alaska has as far as resource development, I think that's what you were alluding to.
One of many examples.
Right.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt here, and then because we're going to put some of these questions in, but you know, we should be testing to skills.
Mm-hmm.
It's what these tests should be doing. So the test should be based on skills. So if my third grader is taking a test, that test should show, especially a reading one, that he has all the skills that he needs as a third grader to be able to read. Because we're giving this at the end of the year, and if he passes that, then it shows that he's ready for fourth grade. I think where we make our mistakes. That our frustration up here is that we give these tests, but we don't do anything with it. So let's say all of us take the test and we all score differently. It's not like the next week when we go to school, we're all going to get some kind of different curriculum to help us get higher up than what we are. So we're just really testing to see if the material that's being utilized in those schools are giving this is going toward the standards, which are skills. I mean, it really shouldn't be based on values or if we're doing it correctly. And I think that's where your concern is. It's making sure that we don't put a test before our children that are more value-based versus standards. Yes, no?
Pretty much that goes. Just, you know, that there's no national political agenda or anything, you know, such as that may be in conflict with the jobs that are available, you know, in the state.
Through the chair, these standards really are about reading, writing, mathematics. I think some of the concerns you're raising, we'd have to be very careful when we get into science or if we ever tested social studies, some of those that do have more value-driven issues with them. That is not the issue with these standards. The items will test those standards. I don't think there's any values agenda that is going to be there, and that's not something the commissioner or the governor would want us participating in. So I can assure you that's the case. The only other thing I'd say about teaching to the test versus teaching to the standards, it's very dangerous to teach the test. Typically, if you're teaching the test, it means a teacher has actually saw the test, which actually is a security violation, and teachers have lost their license for doing such things as that. They get reported to the Professional Teaching Practices Commission. And you also need to keep in mind, the next year, items change on the test. So if you're teaching to the test versus teaching to the standards, you may be going too focused in your teaching, and you're not teaching kids to do well on the standards, so that when you face a question that's unfamiliar to you but is based on the standards that were written, how do you perform on it? That's what we're trying to prepare students for. So we really work on that. People sometimes categorize it as teaching to the test, but really we really work to help people teach to the standards and make sure the standards are tested by the test. And the last thing I'll say is we have to actually go through a pretty rigorous alignment process to prove the test tests the standards. It's rigorous to go through that, and you have to prove that. Otherwise, you can't use the assessment for the requirements in the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. So hopefully that answers that question.
So since I know you all know how to read, we're going to kind of really what the next section is, I just kind of wanted you to know that the board has now, the State Board of Education, has passed teacher evaluation. They passed some school accountability. I guess the part that I really want the department to address, because this is what I heard on the CDs, that, and so those who were unable to hear the Board of Education meeting, you can get CDs made and sent to you, which is what I did. And so we're working on that. That's kind of my shot. Thank you. But what I want to know on the school accountability, you go into basically the same thing as No Child Left Behind. We're calling them stars instead of levels. So I want to know what the department, where's the black and white portion of it, that if they start falling from, I can't remember what's the highest. So the star level goes on page 23. So there's points to all these stars, and I think as far as what I heard is that we're going to have incentive packages for schools if they meet certain things, and then I guess there'll be plans that will have to be made if they start falling down on the scoring. So I want to hear from the department, what is it, you know, what kind of cost are we looking at? Are we looking to continue to do what we're doing right now with some of the more challenged schools where the department's paying, not the department, but the state, is paying for the mentors and the specialists and all the additional help versus the school districts. And the reason I bring that is because what I heard in my office more than anything is from those schools that were achieving what they were supposed to do, they were on the string. You know, they were barely hanging on. They get no additional resources. Basically, I don't even know if they get a nice job, to be honest with you, but they're just surviving over here, doing the best with what they have while they watch other districts get all this additional help when they both have been given the base student allocation and should be able to get there. So I just want to hear how this STAR system is different than the levels that No Child Left Behind and who will be responsible to pay whatever costs associated with however you're rated. And then we'll get into the funding, which I know everybody's dying to hear.
I'll just do my best to answer your questions, Chair Wilson. So this is the component of that the waiver permitted that would in no other way have been permitted. While we have state authority to adopt standards, we have state authority to develop teacher and administrator evaluation regulations, we don't have, without a waiver from ESEA, state authority to develop our own accountability system. The waiver permitted that. And so what would have otherwise gone in place this year was a big jump up in annual measurable objectives with the expectation that 94.2% of our kids be proficient in language arts, all kids, and 91.5% proficient in math. And that
it was what proficient is, a definition of it?
Meaning that they have scored the score on the SBAs of proficient, which is about 300. So they hit a 300. If they're at a 297, not proficient. If they're at a 301, proficient. And what it means then is that 94, the expectation through adequate yearly progress was that 94% of our kids needed to hit that. And all of the metrics, the accountability systems for rating districts, for rating schools, were driven by that annual measurable objective. So just by way of some examples of the implication of that, last year, about 236 out of 509 schools met annual yearly progress. This year, with the jump in AMOs, it would have been, and that by the way, is about 46% of our schools. This year, it would have been 20 schools, 4% of our schools. Mm-hmm. And next year, the metric was 100% of our schools were supposed to be, 100% of our students were supposed to be proficient. So when schools don't hit that metric that was set up a long time ago to get to 100% proficient by 2014, then all of the consequences kick in. Then all of the reporting requirements then kick in. Then all the restricted use of title funds kick in. And so the waiver permitted workaround and an allowance that we develop our own accountability system with parameters. Again, it wasn't do whatever you want. It was not you can get rid of annual measurable objectives entirely. It wasn't that, but the new system is very, very different than adequate yearly progress.
It's 300 out of what's the maximum points I can get on the test?
It depends on the grade.
It does depend on the grade a little bit, but it generally runs from 100 to 600, and it's in the middle. The proficiency level's in the middle, but that doesn't mean it's 50%.
So what grade would I have to have? So are we talking about, if I was getting, basically 70%, like a C or above, I would be proficient? Are we looking at 50%, so D? I mean, because 300 means nothing to me if I don't know what I'm comparing it to.
This is part of the challenge with having a locally normed assessment and comparability with national norms. So proficiency, for example, proficiency on our in-state assessment can correlate to on a national assessment about the 38th or 40th percentile. It's a very different look. This is why districts are using nationally normed assessments voluntarily like measures of academic progress, because it's giving them what they think is helpful in terms of how are my students doing on a nationally normed assessment. So my point there, Representative Wilson, is that we're talking about things that are very difficult to compare, because this our state assessment and the proficiency percentages set are set on our local state norms, not a national look at proficiency across the country. It's Alaska.
I'm not looking national.
Okay.
I'm looking is if my third grader takes the test and they come home with their little report, hey, Mom, look, and it says I'm proficient, mm-hmm. Would that be the same thing as I got a D minus? I'm just trying to, and I've been looking at all this data about proficient and I can't really pin it down to, what grade-wise, can I read at a proficient level? What does it mean? So if I'm getting, if Anchorage School System shows 90% of their third graders are proficient, can we say 90% of them can read at a third grade level?
That the proficiency is correlated to meaning having attained basic skills at that grade level. So, yes, basic skills based on our previous standards at that grade level.
Okay. I wasn't trying to compare it to others.
Got it.
Yeah, want to know what that student can do when, say, because that's the argument I have heard as far as when the department or whoever, I don't know who made the cut scores, I'm assuming the department did, is that it's my understanding, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong, because I couldn't even tell you who I heard it from, is that when the state made their tests to start with, they had a pretty high cut score, and students weren't achieving at that level, so they changed it until those percentages came. So is that true, or is that partially?
Representative Wilson, that's the high school graduation qualifying exam. That is true on that. But that was in response to legislative action that actually added the language of saying instead of it just being a high school exam, it's a essential skills test of basic competency, or basic competency of essential skills. That's not true of the standards-based assessment, which has been the same cut score since 2005, which actually is set through what it's, I don't want to take the committee's time now, but it's a pretty complicated process called standard setting process. It involved probably about 120 stakeholders, including lots of educators, actually helping to come to what that cut score ought to be, and then the state board adopted their recommendations.
Okay, so it was a high school. So now that we put our own system, our own Alaskan system together, what are Alaskans going to do to make sure that all of our schools are able to perform at a level that in which we want our children to be able to be at?
See if I can...
Will the department step in? I mean, that's the question I'm asking.
Okay.
Let me be blunt. Will the department step in? Because we know we have challenged districts, and we've had them for many years, so many years that children have probably graduated in a very poor system as we figure out whether or not we have nerve enough to step in. So with this system, is there a clear-cut way for districts to know that when I start, you know, if I'm five stars, do what they, you know, they're obviously doing it. But when I get to a four-star, to a three, to a two, is the department ready to step in with pretty strong measures? Because I don't want to see any of them at a one or two-star.
So our new accountability regulations establishes language to bring, I guess, parameters to and direction around when those things happen. The new regulations establish three things that I think are relevant to your question. It requires the identifying of priority schools, which are one-star schools, the lowest 5% of Title I schools, the lowest performing, according to the new metric of the Alaska School Performance Index, the lowest performing 5% Title I schools in the state are identified as priority schools. The next lowest performing 10% of Title I schools are identified as focus schools. Those schools have additional expectations regarding school improvement planning, regarding oversight from the department, regarding the approval of the plans from the department, regarding the assigning by the department of an EED liaison, regarding the assigning to particular schools through conversations with district office administrators of state system of support coaches. So increased expectations for schools is not a, a qualitative sort of consideration, but what do these accountability structures say in terms of student achievement in those schools? The other piece that was maintained in our regulations but now made more consistent with the new metrics are identifying each district in the state as a Tier 1, Tier 2, or Tier 3 district. Tier 3 districts receive increased oversight from the department, where we're matching our supports to what is needed. We're talking about where are the schools in your district, your Tier 3 district, that most need support, and what are the expectations in terms of what must happen in those schools. So that is a blending, though, of the ability of Alaska to bring our accountability system, but it's tied to an expectation by the federal government that we do that. The identification of priority and focus schools is a requirement of the ESEA waiver. We had to say we're going to do that, and we had to identify in our waiver application who those schools were based on 2012 data, which we did.
So who pays for that extra support in those schools?
We are using, and this, some of this may be at the end in the funding, we are using federal funds for that. We are using, in some cases, our state system of support coaches, which are general funded in-state to support those schools. You mentioned both the You mentioned the teacher mentors, the Alaska Statewide Mentor Project, and the Alaska Administrative Coaching Project. Both of those are state-funded programs, but they are not linked to low-performing schools. So they're what we would – they're – all schools have equitable access to them because they're linked to being new in the field, either as a teacher or administrator. So those two programs are not linked to school performance. The state system of support coaches, and we have 12 next year, that's pure GF funded, though that's an in-state program, that is very much linked to low-performing districts and schools in the state. And low-performing according to this accountability system, these metrics.
So I could be a low-performing school, as long as I'm not Title I, I'm not going to be put into this mix.
No. Sorry, Chair Wilson, no, that was a little abrupt.
That's okay.
no, that's
yeah,
not true.
It's kind of that way anyway.
So the waiver required that we identify priority and focus schools. Priority get the most attention, focus get the next most attention in terms of expectations and support to meet those expectations. It required minimally that we include the 5% of the lowest performing Title I schools and the next 10% of the lowest performing Title I schools, minimally. We could have gone beyond that. We could have said we want to have twice that many, but we have to have the resources then to do that. We stuck with the minimum required identifier.
That's not my question.
Okay.
Why Title I? Why should it matter whether I'm a Title I school or not? I mean, that's why I'm trying. I mean, because I had a school that pretty much wasn't going to be Title I because parents wouldn't sign up. And for those who don't know what Title I is, based on income, levels, free lunches, reduced lunch, paperwork. It's not necessarily, I mean, your school might qualify, but the parents usually won't participate in that. You just don't get the same resources. So I'm assuming you're saying Title I because with Title I comes federal funding that comes along with it. But, you know, it just seems like we're making this split between those who get Title I and those who don't. And to me, it should be based on where are they performing at.
So two things, Representative Wilson. One is that, that emphasis on Title I with regard to focus and priority schools was driven by the federal government. And because there are historically large achievement gaps with low-income children. And so that's the thinking behind that. However, in our accountability regulations, we were able to establish what the expectations would be for low-performing schools irrespective of Title I status. So we've said all 1- and 2-star schools in the state has nothing to do with title status. Some of them are title, some of them are not. All 1- and 2-star schools in the state will do a school improvement plan. They will be assigned an EED liaison for that purpose. They have to do the school improvement plan with 6 domains and criteria for each domain on a state-prescribed planning tool. We at the department are organizing our staff, who are my staff, around how we're going to be approving those plans. They not only have to do them, they have to be approved by the department. And that is specific to and exclusive to 1- and 2-star schools, all 1- and 2-star schools. And we were able to identify that in the waiver. That wasn't driven by the federal government.
And I'm sorry, but I can't remember what the determination on the date. When will these, because this happens this year, correct? So you'll be starring all schools and districts? Are they two separate or just districts or schools?
Chair Wilson, just schools receive a star rating. The preliminary ASPE, Alaska School Performance Index, reports went out by the deadline and regulation, which was July 1. We anticipate the final public designations on August 15th. So for the first time on August 15th, yeah.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead. Representative Wilson.
Thank you. My question is, the way we did it before and how people or how schools were classified and how we ended up helping them was when they were pretty far along and they were really in trouble. And what I'm wondering is it set up now so we can catch them before they get to that point? Or are we still going to be catching them at the same stage?
Yes, a couple of things. You know, know, I'm feeling like you have, might have a better response than I actually hear what you just
yeah.
said in my ear.
Well, yeah. I was, my first thought was, in the past, what you do is you miss AYP, and you miss AYP again. By the time you get to level five AYP, all these consequences fall in place. Under our new system, you might be a level one school or a one-star school right away. We don't wait till you are missing five times. You're a one-star school. You're a one-star school the first year. There isn't waiting for a level five of something. So I do think it actually, this system distinguishes the performance of schools from the first day in a much finer way than even when you looked at schools that missed AYP. There are schools that missed AYP that any one of us in this room would have sent our children to.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
There will be schools that are one-star schools that parents in those, of those kids in that school, I think, will be saying, this has got to change. This has got to change immediately. And I think we will distinguish better between schools so that we know where low performance is and where performance that's okay but has problems. I wouldn't be thrilled to be a three-star school. I want to be a five-star school. I think that will all get really clear. But to answer Representative Wilson's question, that will happen. The first rating comes out. We don't have to wait till they're level five years down the road.
If I might add one more thing. As the metric, as the annual measurable objective jumped up and up and up, it became very diffuse. No one could tell anymore who was doing well, in fact, and who wasn't doing well, because if a school missed it in just one target, it was the same as far as public information of missing it in five or six or seven or eight or nine targets. It was a did not meet AYP. So the system had outlived its, in my opinion, had outlived its usefulness in form of, in terms of informing certainly parents and the public about who was doing a good job and who wasn't. It was, did they make it or not? And whether it was in six categories or one, it was still the same label of did not meet AYP and in the minds of a lot of folks, failing school, which is just inaccurate. So this system is much more discriminating in terms of discriminating in a good way is what I mean, in terms of being clearer about schools that are doing what we would expect in doing a good job and schools that are really struggling and need some serious improvement.
A follow-up, Madam Chair?
Right ahead.
So the star ratings are going to be on every single school, not just the schools that are Title I.
Through the chair, that's correct.
And then the first year, depending on how they – so the stars don't happen until after this first series of this coming year, and then they'll get the stars, or do they have the stars already, or how does that work?
Through the chair, they will they have a – they have their preliminary ASPE information right now. It does not have the attached star rating on it because some of the data – are not the ACT and SAT, for example. So they have their preliminary ASPE right now. They will have their final Alaska School Performance Index score and the correlating star rating, which our timeline is that will be public information on August 15th is what our internal planning is.
This coming year?
Yes, of this year.
Yes, this August 15th.
Okay, great.
I'm still not clear, and it kind of follows that same time, that same star rating. But you talked about 5% of the folks on the bottom, and then the next 10%. And I guess in my mind, I'm thinking, why the percentages versus the, I mean, if there's a, you know, it kind of sounds like, you know, there's a star rating of 5 all the way to 1, and then the minus stars, if you will, but why would you choose just the bottom 10% or the bottom 5? Conceivably, you could have half of our schools that fell under there, but you'd only be picking that very small portion. Why wouldn't we go all of the folks that are falling behind? I mean, what's the rationale?
Yeah, to the chair, Representative Gaddis, twofold. The rationale, first and foremost, is that that was what was required for the waiver. And second, we need, if we're going to move beyond that, if we're going to, for example, expand the number of schools above the minimum that we designate as priority or focus, we must, the regulation, sorry, the ESEA waiver requirements don't restrict our identifying them to title schools. It says that minimally the bottom five must be. I strongly share your sentiments. We've had a lot of discussion about this at the department. But if we expand that designation of priority and focus schools beyond title and beyond the minimum number of required, right, we then have to both apply consequences and have resources to support their improvement. And, for example, we have funding, general funds, for 12 state system of support coaches. So we are going, looking at the data and determining where are the neediest places in terms of student achievement to send those coaches for 1 week a month. So it's a matching. It's both a meeting the requirements, but then also matching existing resources to the supports and the expectations that need to happen when we expand our designations beyond the minimum required.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
So what happens to the rest of them then? Because we don't have the funding, so we're just going to let them swim and sink?
No. So one and two star schools get no tie to title status, have to do school improvement plans. They have to address the six effective school domains in that are in their regulation, actually. Each of the criteria, it has to be approved by the department.
I'm going to stop you, but I don't think that's the question. I think the question is, if there's, let's say there's 30 schools that are two-star. Let's say there's no one-star, they're two-star. All 30 of those schools won't get help because you're telling us only the bottom 5% does. So maybe only 10 of those schools are the bottom five. So those 10 schools get extra help, and the other 20 don't get anything because they're not low enough.
No, and I'm going to ask Dr. McCauley to correct me if I'm wrong, because she has a more in-depth knowledge of this. But I'm going to take a shot at trying to answer it. So one star is a state label.
Right.
We could have called it the pink schools. The feds didn't care whether it's one star or five star. They didn't. Their language is priority and focus. So
right. And we don't
real
care
clear
either
about that. So we have one star and two star schools, and she was mentioning the plans will require, but she also mentioned for those one star schools, they'll have liaisons from the department. That's the support we would provide. Often it comes in a SOS coach. It may come in some fashion, but there'll be a liaison to those schools and requirements.
And who's going to pay for those?
Well, right now,
I know we're a broken record, but
well, right now, some of that funding is coming out of the general fund, so it's the state legislature when you allocate the money to the state system of support.
But you're saying liaisons now. You're not saying are you using liaisons instead of specialists? You mean the same thing?
So we're looking now at staff within the Division of Teaching and Learning Support, and now our new regulations, and making sure that we are adjusting responsibilities within the division to match the requirements of our accountability regulation. So we're going, okay, when the metrics shake out, how many schools are there to whom we need to assign liaisons to make sure that those school improvement plans are done well and are approved by us? How many do we need, and who in the division is going to do that? We're taking a systemic look at responsibilities in the division and looking at what is currently on their plate and who are the how many do we need and who are going to be those liaisons.
You're saying all schools that are star one and two are going to get these liaisons and this help, no matter whether that's 30% of our schools or 5% of our schools.
All one and two star schools are required to have a school improvement plan approved by the department with technical assistance from the department to make sure they know how to do it and that they're doing it according to the tool, the school improvement planning tool that's approved in our regulations.
Madam,
go ahead.
So I just want to clarify that I'm thinking right in my head here. The feds are saying that you have to have at least a minimum. And so let's say that there are 50 schools in Star 1 and 20 in Star that have 2 stars. Okay, so but you only have mentors that go out for, let's say, 12 of those schools. So you have mentors going out for 12, but the rest of them, all the rest of them that are in star, 1 star and 2 star, are going to be helped by the department. And the department is going to do the best they can. But now, if there's a lot more than what you anticipate, and you still have to deal with them because we want to help them meet those standards, so what we're going to have to do is the department is going to have to ask the legislature maybe for 2 more people.
Through the chair, we are currently, and again, we don't have the 2013, the new star rating designations final yet.
Right.
We are looking at, when we do, a comparison of how that shakes out in terms of how many are 1 star, how many are 2 star, what our resources are for assistance, and whether or not there is a need for additional resources that may result in a request. But we've not. I want to be careful with saying that because we haven't done that, and we're doing all of this for the first time. So we want to be really thoughtful about it, and we want to take a really good look at our existing resources and the effective use of those resources in terms of existing staff. But yes, what you said is it is possible that we would say, with our current 12 state system of support coaches, here is where we've chosen to place them, and here is why. If we had additional coaches, we would make recommendations for this, or we would make a recommendation for this many additional based on these data and these school ratings. So that is all the work that is ahead of us in the very near future, in the next month. In the meantime, we have 12 coaches. We are looking over the preliminary data, and just this week, the commissioner and I talked about the placement of those coaches, and we are moving into that conversation with the 12 we have.
Sure. Okay. That I just wanted to make sure I understood that, and that's fine. Thanks.
We're going to go right to funding, and if everybody has questions, email them to me, and we'll get those in writing. But so one of the questions I had asked was, if we decide we want to be true Alaskans and we don't want this help and all these regulations, what will it cost us? Because we all know there's a cost to when we want to be independent.
There is always a cost. I say you can do anything if you have the right amount of money. So you can...
You find a better funder than the federal government.
So what I'm going to do in terms of these costs is lay out the money that ESEA brings in. And then some of this is a little bit of crystal ball because the answer gets very fuzzy, and you'll see why. But I think starting with the basis of... ESEA brings in this amount of money. So the let's go to that slide. The other thing that I'll do is...
Oh, we're on page 30 for those who...
Yeah.
I'm
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, we're on page 30. So
kind of skipped around here at the end to make sure.
And
that
keep in mind the bottom line number, which is $69 million. So this is the funding that comes to the state for the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. And then what I'll do is give you detail behind any of these programs in a separate attachment from the PowerPoint that's also online for anyone that has that. And then I have 4 examples of 4 school districts that I brought, primarily because I thought it was school districts members were familiar with, that it could make sense to them. So let me just start with this. What I did is broke down every program under the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, the amount of money that that program brings in, and then just so you see the state agency impact, I put the number of employees at the department that are funded from that line item. So ESEA Title I grants to the LEAs, we have a responsibility to monitor all of those. That is $37,200,000 that comes in. The vast majority of that goes out Well, that money goes out to school districts, of which there are seven people at the department who monitor and make sure that those things are compliant. I'm not going to walk through each one of these, because what you can do, let me now refer to the two attachments. What you can do is on the first attachment, and on the online, if people are looking for what I'm referring to as the first attachment, each document was either labeled 1, 2, or 3 at the beginning, and I checked online, and they have those labels on the ledge page.
Hey, right.
So I'm referring to the document that starts with a number 2 numerically written, and it actually is a duplicate slide of slide 30. What's behind that is something we provided to you as legislators during the legislature, but I just pulled the federal grants related to Elementary Secondary Education Act. So if you want to study a little bit more, well, what is the fourth one on here, which is Title I, Part 1003G, School and District Improvement, number 4, I've labeled it in this document as number 4, and it appears on the second page, and then that can tell you the purpose of that program. Let me also describe one other thing about the pages that back up this document. You'll see a percent at the end of each of these columns. So if I can just take you to the first page of our Title I, it says Title I, Part A, Grants, Basic. It's in bold. Then at the end of that paragraph description, which describes the purpose of that program, it says funding is 95.6% of the total grant award. There are there are five components of that first Title I grant. If you look at those percentages at the end of each of those lines, will add up to 100%. So that's where the money that's where that $37,200,000 go. So the other thing that I provided you, which is labeled number 3, numerical 3 in the handouts, is I put together from last year's report, so this is FY13 money, the money that districts get, and I pulled 4 districts. I pulled Anchorage, Fairbanks, Matsu, and North Slope, because the members of this committee, that are communities that you're familiar with. If you want any one of the districts, though, it is provided in a report that we provide to the legislature every February 15th. We can get you copies of that. So I'm just going to use Anchorage to start with to walk you through it. But you can just go down the table and see the number of dollars that they get. In the first several there, it says No Child Left Behind Consolidated Application, and it has Title I, II, and III written there. Those are ESEA funds. And actually, you can continue on below that. I had meant to actually draw a line along all of them, and I actually missed some. So you have to go below that, and you see Alaska Community Learning Centers. That's ESEA grant. Actually, go several down. You'll see McKinney Vinto Homeless, Migrant Book, Migrant Program. Those are ESEA funds. And then you go near the bottom of the page to see Title I-A, Title I-D, Title I-D again. And those are all labels that match the document on slide 30 as well as the prior document. And you can see how much money they get. In this particular district, it gets $35,194,968 of federal funds. That's all of their federal funds that come through the Department of Education. That, though, includes their special ed money and those kinds of things. But those that match these titles. So that gives you a picture of the state money, picture of the district money. If you chose not to participate in ESEA, I can tell you definitely would lose all that money. You might lose more, and this is why. Some of the requirements that are here, as requirements here, actually also have crossover in terms of IDEA. So if you go into IDEA, you would find, oh, there are some things there.
What's IDEA?
I'm sorry for that. The Individual Disabilities Education Act. There'll be things in there that require that you provide potentially support for a school that's underperforming. But the only way to figure out if a school is underperforming is if you have an accountability system, which ours is tied in with ESEA. So there may be some costs there. Honestly, if this was really a path we went down, we'd have to really have lawyers digging into what are the implications probably in IDEA, maybe with child nutrition services. I don't think so, but maybe. And certainly with career and technical education, Carl Perkins dollars, which is much smaller. It's about $4 million for the whole state. And I don't think there's an impact to impact aid, but we'd have to look at that. But I don't think there's an impact with that. So you would want to look broader. What I can tell you is this would be the cost. And then in terms of what does it really cost districts, I think if we had to weigh this out, they would probably say, yeah, there's bureaucracy to it. But the money they get, I bet they would say is worth the bureaucracy to it. There are some programs that have gotten so small where districts do say it's not worth it, and Carl Perkins is actually one where some of our districts simply don't participate because the paperwork is more than the amount they get to kids. But I don't know that that would be true with ESEA for any district.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm a little confused. Mr. Morris, you said that this act looks like it's part of the LBJ War on Poverty and all the other initiatives that were passed in the 1965, actually, that year. Mm-hmm. We've been receiving money through ESEA for 48 years, some money. Mm-hmm. Is there someone, including anyone in this room, who thinks that we should stop doing that?
Through the chair.
Well, no, what I want to do, because this was my question, so I don't want to, you know, because we get that question a lot, you know, what if we just were totally independent and we did our education system in the way that we wanted? And we might decide an accountability system, but we just, you know, we might want to make a rural test and an urban test. So, you know, I kind of want the department to put something together so that when the constituents say, well, is it worth our while for all, you know, to do the teacher evaluation, not just because of what it does for education. So I kind of really wanted everybody else to see charts like this of how it's tied together. Mm-hmm. Because I think I know I've gotten from constituents feeling like, well, we just don't need to take the federal money. And I remind them, do you know what that looks like? And so I really wanted to see what numbers were so we could go back and say, well, you know, if Anchorage wants to give it up, that's fine, but they're probably looking around $35 million. And does Anchorage want to tax themselves enough to make up that $35 million? I'm probably figuring the answer is no. And so, but unless you really get those figures to find out why all this changed and what's it tied to, I just figured we need to see that as dollars. The department has made no indication that they want to give any of this up.
And if I could add one more
thing.
And
if I'm wrong, let me know.
No, if I could add one more thing to bring context. It actually was a question posed, and I thought it was a rather provocative question to say, well, what, and a good way to look at, well, what federal dollars does come in because of this. So I don't know.
Yes, absolutely.
When you're talking to people.
Mm-hmm.
The other piece that I think is important is the total federal dollars. I thought it would be useful. This actually comes out of your budget book, the now operating 14 budget.
Of course, we all knew that.
But the amount of total federal dollars that comes into the agency, much of it going straight out to districts, the vast majority of it, the total authorization for federal dollars that our department functions on is $233,903.8. So that's the total federal dollars. That includes special ed, everything. The $69 million is the ESEA dollars. So these dollars, when I say total federal, that's, you know, food, nutrition money, all of that. And that's what our authority is to accept. So
in the $233 million, because there's a difference between authority and how much money you really get, so do we receive $233 million in total in federal funds now, and then we're talking about approximately $69 million would be in jeopardy? I just want to make sure, because authority just means you can keep going out and look for more grants versus actual funds.
Right. So what we actually receive is going to be somewhat less than that. I don't have that exact figure with you. We've worked with the legislature to try to have our authority come close to matching what we receive. So if we're going out and receiving something significantly larger, we actually come either to the legislature or LBNA to ask for an increase in our authority. I'd have to actually go back to some actuals of last year to get the actual amount that we received in the last fiscal year.
That would be nice. Just for the 1 year, what was the total amount of federal dollars that we received? And then how much are we looking at if we didn't do this? What percentage of that? And I'm still not saying that we shouldn't take it. I think it's just good to know that how much it is, and then do you feel like between the different employees and all the additional personnel that districts have to put in for that, I think we're still at we gain more than we lose. But as the federal dollars go down, that may not always be true.
Yeah, Chair Wilson, I think right now I'd say it is worth continuing to take those dollars, but I would say when a program gets really tiny, people have to make decisions, and people have chosen in districts to say, we're not taking Carl Perkins. It's a $4 million program statewide, so if you're a really small district, you have to hire someone to manage it. Well, you've taken all your money to manage it. You're not getting managed soon, so just don't take it. The problem with ESEA, it's larger, so they get a good amount of money for that. And the other piece is if they chose not to participate, they're not free from giving the tests. They're not free from those things because they still have to participate in a state accountability system. It's just right now we've used federal and state to try to bring one accountability system together, so they'd still be faced with requirements.
And I think many believe that did not know that ESEA was already intact. I think a lot of people thought it was a new program to replace NCLB, and it isn't. So if there's no other questions, I know people have planes and other things. I want to thank you guys for taking your afternoon to do this. Get some questions. We will be planning another meeting probably after the STAR system comes out to see what it looks like, because I think there's probably still a little confusion, but having numbers and schools and where they're going to go will make it a lot easier. So with that, it's about 4:30, and again, thank you to the department as well.